So what do we want to talk about? You got something?
Question that I was having a talk earlier with Adrian. Talking about letting go and, you know, how much of the ego are you letting go of? Do you, you know, you don't want to let go of everything, and kind of this idea of, you know, I'm more familiar with the way Ajahn Jeff talks about it, about like developing a healthy sense of self.
Right.
And he's got this whole concept of like the mind's committee, and, you know, getting rid of all these unskillful voices in your head and replacing them with more skillful ones.
Yeah.
I was wondering what you might have to offer on that subject.
Well, I've thought about that. For me, the way it's worked for me is because really I became an adult as a monk. Before that I was a old adolescent. So really, I developed all those characteristics and traits of being a human being who wasn't just selfish all the time and took responsibility through monastic training. And the monastic training was a constant set of suggestions to live my life in a certain way. Contentment with little, being, developing gratitude, being humble to my elders, being responsible for the work that's given me. And so those paramita qualities developed partially by me abandoning the former habits. They were still there. I mean, I wasn't like grateful all the time by any means, but just a suggestion all the time, contentment with little, gratitude. And I had, you know, because people were so generous to me, you know, it only made sense, you know, because I'm a monk and I live by the goodness of others. So all those that they talk about, like developing a healthy self, came about through the training that Ajahn Chah and the Vinaya gave us. And I only realized that later. At the time, I was just, you know, I was caught in my own resentments and fears and all the rest of it. But the structure always helped me to reflect on that which was egotistical and then cultivate the paramitas. So the way I look at it now is what I was cultivating were wholesome habits. And I always look through the paramita model, the virtuous qualities of patience and morality and so on. The paramitas are 10 virtuous qualities which are used a lot in Theravada Buddhism: morality, generosity, wisdom, compassion, determination, patience, those kind of qualities. And I could see, like in these early days of monastic life, I wasn't very patient. I wasn't terribly grateful, but I could see that those things I needed to develop. And so for me, I guess, the, like, developing the social character of well, what is the purpose of social character? To me, it's for stability, for realizing the unconditioned, for the realization of Nibbana. And that stability is a kind of joy, first of all, from living a good life, no remorse, no regret, and being a responsible male adult, rather than just an adolescent kid, which is what I came in at 25, but I wasn't very mature. You know, I was just a long-haired LSD kind of kid. So there was no real, you know, sense of responsibility. I wasn't a bad person. So when I look back at it, I see that whole structure and form helped me, you know, to develop those characteristics. I didn't know I was doing it. I just had faith and it, you know, made a lot of sense. So then if I think of lay people, I think, okay, so what is the structure and form that a lay person can give themselves to, which helps to develop those selfless qualities, which are, because like patience or wisdom, they're not about ego, are they? You know, they're about living skillful in the world. And then the language you use for that, Tanisiro's language or whatever, makes a lot of sense. So I never, like when I heard the psychology community saying you have to develop a strong ego before you can let go of the ego, that language never appealed to me. I didn't say it was wrong, but it wasn't the kind of intellectual model that I was attracted to. But what attracted me more was like, yeah, I got, you know, like abandoning the unwholesome and developing the wholesome through, you know, the classic teachings on right effort and the Paramita teaching a lot. And I, again, I didn't know that explicitly, but what Lopa Chai was suggesting all the time was something around the Paramitas, especially like endurance and patience. You know, you said, you've got bad habits. You know, if you're going to live this life, you're going to have to be very, you have to endure a lot of suffering and you're going to have a lot of pain. Thanks a lot, right? Until you become, you know, more stable. And not that it was bad or, you know, totally freaked out or anything, but it was just a kind of a life which was kind of sloppy. It was sincere, but it was kind of, you know, sloppy, I suppose. So, I mean, it's true. You need to develop the worldly dharmas to enough that your mind is really stable. But they don't have to be, they're not ego commitments. You know, they're more characters of, they're more types of strengths, certainly. When you think about like generosity and gratitude, that's a strength of mind. You know, when I can reflect on, God, I'm really lucky. I'm really lucky to have so much goodness. How does that come about? Well, I have to live a good life. You know, gratitude won't come about if I just rob banks or, you know, or I'm just selfish. So gratitude is that barmi you develop by living a good life. But you see how it works that way. But that's not like me being grateful as a kind of demand. Like, the, you know, Ajahn Smith teaches very well about idealism, right? So like the idea that I should be grateful will never work. It's just seeing the skill of gratitude as to the suffering of ingratitude, you realize, oh, go towards gratitude. That's really going to liberate you. So you incline towards that. But I think quite often when you hear things like, you know, you should be grateful, and you know, all the people in China are starving, that kind of thing, it just becomes a kind of cliche. But when you see how, like, say, as an example of a barmi, how gratitude works for your meditation, and you see how it's totally contrary to desire. And desires will keep your mind restless, right, into objects. And you see, no, gratitude actually really settles the mind. It fits in with a whole package of both social, conventional life and as a foundation for enlightenment. And those are the very important things. Yeah. Otherwise, you get no real stability. So sometimes people can meditate in a kind of pristine environment where there is control. But then when that pristine environment isn't there, they have their karma to deal with. And that's where they have to develop those things. So for lay people, the challenge is to have enough friends, I think, to support that kind of integrity. Because society is not built for enlightenment. It's designed for consumption, right? I read an interesting one. Here's one. If you're taking a bus in Seoul, Korea, you let's say you're in Seoul, Korea, and you're looking at your gadget probably, right? Your iPad or whatever. When you reach a certain station, the mechanical ventilation in the bus will emit the smell of donuts and coffee. And at the same time, which will awaken you from your iPad, at the same time there'll be an announcement on the PA system about Dunkin' Donuts. And the stop that you reach there, you get off and there'll be a Dunkin' Donuts shop there. I mean, it's horrible. It's absolutely horrible. It's just kind of, it's just like kidnapping you.
Marketing to the highest.
Yeah, it's like, And they're grabbing your attention. The book I'm reading is very, very interesting. He says the commodity that is most important to us is attention. Is what we pay attention to is our reality, or how we pay attention. And what modern consumerism, it steals your attention. It puts out the smell of coffee and donuts. Then you get distracted. Dunkin' Donuts, and there it is. So it steals your attention and creates your world. Oh, that was a really interesting essay. Yeah.
We were talking about doing something like that in movie theaters or something.
Yeah?
Just adding in more sensory things, smells. And
popcorn and butter.
Well, yeah. No, but I mean more like with the movie.
Oh, with the movie itself.
Yeah. So that you're totally immersed.
You know what? This writer, the way he was putting it, he says just as food, fast food now uses salt, sugar, and fat to make it really delicious, creating obesity. He says that's the same with the audio and visual media. That it's creates a kind of obesity of mind where you no longer have any attention for contemplating or you know, being peaceful or whatever. And that sense of attention being free and available is very important to spiritual life, because as long as you're preoccupied with objects, you're never going to understand the teaching, you know, deeply, profoundly. That's why these places are important, where you get a bit of break, right, from all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's...
I was reflecting, John, about... you read about letting go the other day in the morning request after that. So letting go and developing paramis, they are all, I find, that to give up some of your likings and dislikings, right? Which comes from the ego level, so...
It's habit.
Yeah, it's a habit.
Comfort.
Yeah.
So
giving up, yeah. So without specifying, like, without specifically thinking of, okay, developing renunciation, generosity, obvious, it comes from when you do some service to somebody.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yeah. It comes naturally.
Yeah.
That's just the intellectual package.
Right.
But by you serving your family, you're developing all those paramitas.
Yeah.
You know, when you go to Burlington,
yeah,
and you take care of your daughter and your grandkids, you're not a youngster anymore.
No.
You know, it's hard work.
Yeah.
So you have to give up a lot.
Yeah.
You have to be patient with the children. You're giving up your own desires. That's all paramita.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you come here to recover.
Yeah.
But no, it's... And developing paramita is not, you know, it's not easy.
Yeah.
You know, it's like weightlifting or something. You know, you have to put effort into it. You know, just me taking care of my mom.
Yeah.
You know, you saw how tired I was at the end.
It was
the happiest thing I've done.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a marvelous thing to do, really.
Yeah.
But the doing required the development of paramita. Just be patient and just determined and keep doing it. I mean, I had a beautiful relationship with our mother, so it was easy in that way. And then you come out of it, like, your mind is really solid and stable and happy.
Yeah.
And then when your mind is happy, it's not involved with desire.
Yeah.
And as it's not involved with desire, it can go into deep peace.
Yes.
But if it's unhappy because of, you know, a shoddy lifestyle, like me, you know, I traveled for 3 years as a young dropout and did drugs and all that. I had kind of fun, but in the end of it, I was just confused.
Yeah.
Just utterly, just kind of confused kid. And then Ajahn Chah puts me in jail and keeps me there for a few years. And that's what I needed.
Yeah.
You know, I needed a strong leadership. I needed discipline. I needed morning chanting, evening chanting, work. Older men who had really good values and were strong. I had a lot of good role models. You know, the monks that I was with, they were strong. Farming men, gosh, they were strong. You know, and I was a city kid. So that created these really powerful role models for me that were, you know, they were serious practitioners in the Ajahn Chah himself. So all of that, I think, you know, as a cultural piece quite often can be missing, because the role models that a young guy gets, you know, what is it? He looks at Rambo type movies or whatever, and hockey stars. But, you know, there can be fine people, but yeah, so a lot of culturally influences that way. So stick with it. Yeah, we're very fortunate. Do you understand, Anoma, by what we mean by letting go? What would you say it is?
Letting go of feelings, like all the five senses that coming, is that what?
I would say letting go.
Yes.
Is when you're not using the self idea.
Okay.
Around this moment.
Moment.
So let's say you. Okay, this guy walked in yesterday and surprised you, right?
Yes.
And then you're sitting in the meditation. There was a guest that came in yesterday, a man, who was, he didn't know his way around, and Homer found him upstairs. It's safe, don't worry. But let's say you're meditating, and that memory comes up. Oh, wow, I wonder what's in there. And then you notice that memory. And then you notice the end of that memory, and there's no sense of self-thinking. That's letting go. It isn't the negation of emotion. You still feel your emotions, but it's the self-thinking around anything.
Yeah.
That's the key. So that's what Lumpo Semenas means by cessation. The sense of a storyline and the thinking of me and my kids and my grandkids and so on. Let's say you start worrying about your son or something, right? Or Kosala or something, and your mind's churning that over, and then you notice, and you just let the thinking cease. You still might feel the emotion, but you've no longer grasped that emotion through the thinking process, through the sense of self. That's what letting go means. That's the third noble truth. It doesn't mean that you're some kind of unemotional block. You're like a cabbage or something that never feels anything. You have emotions, but it's the self-thinking. Yeah, it's the key.
What lingers on for me, the perception of that person. Now, all kinds of things come at the same time, but then Priyani was also there. So I had a piece of mind, maybe he's a young kid. He looked so young.
Yeah, he was a sweet kid.
Downstairs, so yeah. That was my first instinct.
He was a sweet guy.
Yeah.
But that's how memory works,
that's
you know.
Yeah.
If you get,
my mind was thinking, what if was another very odd person coming? What would that be in the series? Well, that's a storyline, right?
Yeah, and that's what TV does.
Yeah.
You know, it paints the worst kind of portraits. But that's the storyline. You connect, and then you start thinking, what if the world ended? And so you learn how to really be in the present moment, but be responsible. Otherwise, your mind just constantly jabber, 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 jabber. Especially like intellectual work or something. We're so conditioned to think. Like as a translator, you must get, because as a translator, you're producing a lot of ideas, and that's going to produce a lot of thought. You can't get around it. But to actually give the mind a break and give it rest, very important. Just like doing nothing, just looking at the trees, or very, very important in modern life. Space.
How does either yourself or the person able balance the actual concentration practice, like working with the breath, with working with being with the present moment, being with awareness?
I think it depends on your character and your curiosity. If your character or curiosity really loves concentrated states of mind, you tend to pursue that, and you tend to go the way of jhanas and that way. If your curiosity is more around like the unconditioned, not that they're mutually exclusive, but that's the first thing that grabs you, those kinds of ideas, then the focus on objects, you do just enough to bring your mind to sustained presence and silence, just enough. Because you're not interested in the object anymore. Right? Whereas if you have a propensity for like strong concentration, you love to use the object because it brings you to those deep states of concentration. And then whatever you want to do after that. So it kind of depends on your faculties, how easy you find it to focus on objects. And like for me, my interest came from insights around what awareness was, the profundity of awareness, rather than by absorbing into objects and having very, very ethereal states of mind from that kind of angle. So that was my entry point into it, and that's what I've always been curious about. So just focusing on objects all the time, to me, is still you're focusing on the conditioned. And certainly if you take it to a certain degree, you let go of that, you have a very powerful mind. But that never really interested me. So, but I realized I need to stabilize my mind somehow. So doing breath meditation, doing heart meditation is very important because of a kind of tendency to try to be fearful, a very fearful person, you know, and kind of averse. So like metta practices a lot, but just enough to get the mind into a sustained presence. And then there's an interest in how the sense of self arises and ceases, and what is awareness? What is it? What is awareness within these changing things? So anicca, that kind of thing. And that, for each person, is different.
Yeah. And between those two, I'm typically more familiar with the concentration practice being kind of mandatory for
any,
having the sharpness of mind for uprooting deeper defilement. How does one go about that with awareness?
I would be really wary of the word uprooting. Because what you get into when you use that word is almost a Christian view of original sin. I've got some deep defilements, you know, and I've got to get in there and sort them out. And the danger there would be strong self view. Not necessarily, right? So for me, it seems that defilements are as they are, deep-rooted or not. And the letting go of self-view around them, right in the moment, that is the end of defilement. There can still be a feeling of anger and a feeling of fear, but it's no longer the self-identity. So in like the paticca-samuppada, avijja-paccaya-sankhara, with ignorance as condition, I think for me, it's dropping the ignorance. This is very important. So how much sharpness do you need to do that? I think the real criteria is right understanding. Because if you understand what dropping of self-view is, dropping of doubt is, dropping of rites and rituals, those three fetters, if you understand that, then right there, the Samma Samadhi. If you don't understand that, and you think, I have these deep-rooted defilements, now I have to really practice hard to get rid of these deep-rooted, you're still coming from ego. I am this limited being, and I want to become something else. And that, to me, doesn't work. Because it's already, for me, for others, for me, it's already invested with a sense of time. I am like inadequate now, and I have to get to this other place where I'll be fulfilled. And that whole sense of time, to me, seems cannot be the Dhamma. Because the Dhamma is always like here and now, not a matter of time, transcendent, imminent, all that kind of language. So to me, it seems that the first thing has to be right understanding. And then, if I see that right understanding, and then I notice, say, my mind likes to kind of attach to planning, then I make strategies to look at the planning mind and how not to go there. So then it's not one type of practice for everything. It's a kind of customized practice for the defilements that condition this being, right? Rather than just kind of one practice that is for everything. And then if I see that, okay, the mood of the mind now is really gravitating to, say, some kind of negativity, I can recognize that, and I can put something in to sharpen it up or whatever I need to do. But it's, to me, it seems like it comes from right understanding that the liberation of the heart is always here and now, and it's through non-grasping of these conditions of emotions and body and feelings and so on. And it's understanding that what non-grasping is. And then, okay, how can I just do that for 2 moments, 3 moments, 4 moments? So the sharpness comes from something you're developing from right understanding, rather than you get really, really sharp and then you get right understanding. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You know, that's the way I operate. And then those areas where my mind is kind of, you know, doesn't have strengths, then I... I try to, like, let's say I'm let's say, like, I have a kind of worrying, anxious mind, right? And that's the habit of mind that's very strongly ingrained in me. And you could say that's a deep-rooted kilesa. Yeah, it's a strong conditioning, but it only comes up when it comes up. So when it comes up, my task is not to deny its existence because it's strong karma, but to no longer take it personally. And to keep injecting that attitude is what sharpens my mind around the habit of anxiety. So let's say I start to get anxious about building projects or mocks or whatever. I don't need much to get anxious. I can just grab anything. And there it is. And then, what does it feel like? Then that's right view, and that's sharpness. And then the strength of that, I think that's just karma. You know, the karma of my conditioning is, of the conditioning of this mind-body experience is very strong, that one. I just have to bear with it a long time. If I thought that it's really deep-rooted and I had to root it out, and maybe that's true. Maybe by doing some deep, deep samatha practice, I could just, and it will just disappear forever. But that's not the model I use. You know? So, you know, maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. But it is a model that works for me. And it's a model that and that's why I think Ajahn Sumedho is so important to me. He says it's all that belongs, the fear and the hatred and the delusion and the jealousy and the love and all, it all belongs, and that always opens my mind. So the refuge is in awareness rather than the quality of the conditions. But it you know, really depends on your character. Really, one size fits all, I think, is a really kind of dangerous way to present Buddhism. Mm-hmm. The more reflective you are, the more you find intuitively some combination of things that work for you.
Yeah.
Because it's not formulaic, is it? You can't just kind of grind out a formula. You can for a while, but then you just end up controlling the mind. You don't really free it. Like say monks coming out of retreat and then coming into normal, this isn't normal, monastic life isn't normal, but more personal life, the ones who get attached to the solitude really resent people. And I say, yeah, but they're feeding you, man. And, you know, because they want the silence. And then, no, you have to learn about this too. You have to learn about sensitivity and like reactivity and all those different things. And then you get a really good balance.
Actually, what's the hard practice?
That I do?
Yes.
Well, I start with my mom, maybe, or Lopa Sumedho, or start a lot. And I do breathing exercises by reflecting on the rise and fall of the chest first, right? I just feel rise and fall, and then I start to feel some sensations there, and then I think of Lompo Sumedho, and I just say thank you. In breath, I imagine him. Out breath, thank you. In breath, thank you, and I just quickly get very high with that. So then if it's very strong, then I drop the language. And I just allow that to be the object of awareness and attention. And then I find that's very open. And then when I'm not meditating, I just try to refer to that in a committee meeting, or if I'm talking with the monks in a meeting, I just try to kind of allow my experience of life to come from here rather than from here. And it comes from here a lot, that's the habit. But to come from here is a kind of more listening, receptive quality. And I find if I just bring my attention away from my cerebral functionings and down to the center of the chest, I get comfortable with that in meditation, then I tend to remember it, and that tends to be much more in line with compassion, kindness, forgiveness, all those states of mind which make life relationships much, much more mindful. And then if I'm feeling, you know, irritated by someone, then I'll then I'll use them specifically. Or if I'm feeling cynical, sometimes, you know, I have a strong, I sound really neurotic here, but let's say if there's some cynical mindset going, then I'll do that. So I'll see what my mind's doing, and then if the tone needs, it's kind of like a strength that needs to be toned up all the time, maybe. Because, like, compassion is a strength. You know, the fact that I can relate to someone and not just judge and criticize them is a strength, right? To actually listen and be with them and so on. So if that strength is lacking and I'm just in a very reactive mood, say, or negative, I know you're probably exhausted, you're done, you need rest, that could be. Or it could be just the old habits of cynicism are coming up again. I say no, and then do some metta bhavana like that. Then the heart feels really, really open. And then I don't create any karma with people. I don't create any negative karma because the communication is receptive rather than domineering or critical or judgmental and so on. Not that I get it right all the time, but those practices are very good.
Yes.
And I found that one of the easiest entryways is gratitude. You know, sometimes like the word loving kindness always sounds, to me it sounds a bit too emotional, I suppose. But just like gratitude and openness, that kind of thing. And you take your teacher, think it's easy, eat a piece of cake, right? And then just do that a lot. Your challenge, I think, as a mother would be upeka, you know, around your family, because equanimity, you know, equanimity is very difficult with family relationships because you're so close. You know them so well, you know. So, you know, for a mom, compassion, lots. Kindness, lots. Joy when they're happy, lots. Equanimity when they're suffering, that's the tough one. So then you have to give up, you have to bring up the ideas of karma. You know, like, yeah, they have their lessons. They have to learn something this lifetime. I wish there wasn't this lesson right now or whatever. but you said, yeah, they have their lessons. I have my lessons. I had to learn. They have to learn. So you're still compassionate, but you're no longer carrying their karma, carrying the weight of their weight, you know. That's a hard one, I think, to realize that, no, they have to learn. You give, you know, you do as much as you can, but they have to learn their thing.
Yeah, that's what we do. Yeah, watch that.
Yeah, yeah. Otherwise, you just, you know, you just worry, worry, worry. Your next lifetime, you'll be together again.
Yeah.
Start again. It's, those four are beautiful. Those four, kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. They're the perfection of the heart, I would say. They're the natural expression of the heart when it's not bound by ego. It's just natural.
I find all those listed upekkha and sarasthing, that's the most difficult to develop, I guess. To develop everything else to get to that stage so slowly, much really. Yeah.
It's so early.
Yeah.
Like I say about my mom.
Yeah.
You know, compassion was no problem. Joy was no problem. But seeing her suffer and not getting caught by the desire for her not to suffer, that was the hard one.
Yeah.
And it seems natural, oh, I don't want you to suffer, but and you know, but it's natural. Yeah.
You feel, can I take that pain away?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but the less you suffer, the more you can have peace. You reflect back to the person that's suffering, it's okay. You'll get through this. Yeah, it's a difficult time, but you'll get through that. But the more you're agitated, the more you're frightened, the more you're worried, you know. It feeds it. It feeds it, yeah.
So Acharya, now practice is one thing and meditation when it comes to one thing, right? You concentrate on your when you sit for meditation.
How do you define practice?
practice, when I go into the breath, at one time you feel that there is no breath, then I become sort of quite happy, and then the mind, then I just start talking.
The mind starts talking?
Talking.
What does it talk about?
You know, then something comes up.
Yeah, some idea.
Uh-huh. Yes.
How would you define the word practice?
Practice means like doing a kind act, being generous,
okay,
in that way, right?
Okay.
Like
And meditation?
Yes.
So meditation is like focused?
Right,
focused. On an object, and practice is?
Practicing day-to-day life.
Day-to-day, okay.
What you do to your family or to outsiders or on your...
Right.
Yeah.
So my definition of practice is more general. My definition of practice is letting go of self-view. Okay, all the time. Sitting or sweeping the leaves. So that, the very central core of Buddhism is this idea that of cessation of self-thinking. And that I try to do all the time. That's the core of the practice. And within that, then let's say I'm this isn't true, but let's say I'm having some difficulty with a monk, and I don't want to say hello to him. Not true, but let's say. Then the practice would be looking at that ego of not wanting to say hello, and getting beyond that and say hello. Right? But the practice would be that core thing of self-view, self, right? Or if I was, you know, like when I exercise now, I get on an exercise machine, within a minute, my mind is saying, I don't want this, right? And that's the sense of self. Well, I don't want to do this. I could just read. And I say, no, I think I'll watch the sense of self arising as I do the exercise. Not just push myself to do the exercise, but still do the exercise. So I sit half an hour, and then I watch the thinking mind, thinking, this is stupid, or I could be doing something better, or, oh, it's already 10 minutes, right? And just watching the sense of self arise as negative desire. And that's what you're doing all the time, how the sense of self arises, and how to put it, you know, how to let go of it, to the silence of the mind. So that's the same in sitting practice, the same in cooking in the kitchen, relating your family. And what you see is that when you develop like let's say with pain, you get, you know, after half an hour your body starts to hurt, and you decide, no, I'm going to sit for the whole hour, right? The sense of self is going to rise, you know, how much longer, and am I hurting myself, and you know, I'm already 64 years old, this isn't good for me, and that's the sense of self arising. And if you're going to sit there, that's what you want to let go of. You want to see like restlessness, aversion, as an aramana, as an object of mind, rather than the storyline self-thinking around that. So then the sitting that extra 20 minutes or half an hour, you don't hurt yourself, but you've developed upekkha, you've developed adhittana, determination, you've developed kantibharani, you've developed patience. All those have taken place because you've watched the sense of self, and you've developed wisdom, panya. Right? Mm-hmm. So then that extra 20 sitting, it's not just enduring 20 minutes of meditation, but you're actually watching the sense of self come up. And well, it's just a bodily feeling, you know, coming back to that again and again and again. And if you do that for 20 minutes in a meditation, you'll do that when you're with your kids, because that's the strength of mind. And from that place of non-attachment, you make the best decisions. You really do. So for me, say the exercise, I watch my rationalizing mind. The rationalizing mind is very good. My rationalizer is very, very good at giving me what I want. But what I want might not be very good for me. You know, so after 1 minute, my rationalizing mind is saying, oh, come on, you're too old for this. But actually, I need to exercise, I'm going to die, right? So so I'm not going to believe you. I'm just going to do this for half an hour, thank you. And so you actually learn a lot about yourself that way. Whereas if you're just forcing yourself to do things, you don't learn. You just use willpower and you don't really learn about your mind. So let's any successes your sons have or failures your sons have will bring up a sense of I, right? And you watch that and let go. And still, you know, enjoy their lives in whatever way.
I was reading Ajahn Sumedho's kind of short overview of practice and theory. It's called, is it Mindfulness, the Path to the Deathless?
That's it, yeah.
Yeah. Where he talks about, you know, once you're able to open up that space in awareness and all your thoughts are kind of dropping away, that you can then focus on the sound of silence.
Yeah, he uses that a lot, yeah.
What can you say about that?
Well, if you can recognize that place of emptiness, not vacuity, but empty of self, self-manufacturing, right? That's very important. And then, how can you sustain that for long periods of time? Well, the sound of silence is one way to do that, but some people don't hear it so strongly. Or don't notice it so strongly. Some people experience light. And so the danger is, you start to look for his experience. And he's saying, don't do that, right? So the first thing I think, like in the Third Noble Truth, it says you realize cessation. You realize the end of desire. Not as a final product, but in any given moment. You realize the end of self-manufacturing, ego-manufacturing. And that, I think the first thing is to realize this has happened, it's here now, right? And if you keep making that realization fully conscious, make that, like really say it to yourself, this is it, it's empty. Then that will strengthen your confidence in that, and then it'll depend on your character if you hear the sound of silence, or if you just intuitively just, you know that space and feel that space. But to me, it's the recognition of that and the stating of that to yourself. This is it. So that your mind doesn't strip off looking for something else, some other experience. You know, this is it. This is cessation. The mind is no longer producing a sense of self.
Kind of in relation to that, I've heard it said, I think it was Ajahn Anand that talked about this, that depending on your kind of level of spiritual development, and he was going into the different attainments and stuff, that you're only actually able to be aware of a certain percentage of your thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And I think like at stream entry it was only like 25% or something, and even at anatomy it was like, I don't know, 60 or 70%. When you talk about cessation, is there a separate... I guess that's not identifying with the thoughts, but if you're not aware of the thoughts, is there still a subconscious identification? Or
what can you do about it?
Right.
Right? Well, how can you work with something you're not aware of? That's not conscious.
Right.
Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
You know, if someone tells me I have to work with something I'm not conscious of, that's useless. Kind of, you know, it's like that's just making me feel screwed up. I don't even know what I'm screwed up about.
Right.
Whereas Buddhism is just like, looking at what you can know consciously. And if there are deeper levels, yeah. Yeah, for sure. But I would, yeah, I mean, it's like, how can you work with something, you know? And the more you enter into that, the more profound the stillness becomes. But I don't see it as thought. I see it as more agitation. Because thought kind of falls away. Thought's kind of, well, I don't know what he means by thought.
Does he
mean an inner verbalization?
It wasn't specified. Yeah.
Because sometimes people use thought in different ways. But it's more like restlessness. It's kind of energy rather than, you know, inner verbalization. And then certainly the more you just are with that moment, the deeper, you know, the silent and the sense of relaxation or whatever. But how can you work with something that's not conscious?
But the idea is that with this practice of cessation and staying in that stillness, that that's eventually deepening and you're getting down to those subtler layers of
meditation. Yeah.
And eventually you're working with them.
Then the stillness becomes more and more obvious. And you begin to understand the profundity of awareness. Because then you see any quality that you put into this, you start to look for it as an object. Even the word stillness, you know, you start to seek an object called stillness. And the objectless, or the unconditioned, the uncreated, right, is such a weird sounding phenomena that it is about letting go. And the danger with levels is that you start to think, I'm looking for levels, and you're still looking for an object. Rather than it's just the awareness that's important. So the via negativa, the kind of letting go philosophy, is more like, don't worry about objective levels. Just trust and awareness. That's why Ajahn Smith is very appealing to me. Whereas when someone says to me, well, you've only touched 10%, and you get 90% rubbish underneath that, you know, thanks a lot. But how do I work with it? Whereas if you're working with awareness, then that to me is the only thing that somehow relates to the unconditioned. Everything else is conditioned. Then you're kind of moving in the right direction. It's almost like if you emphasize attainment and levels and all that, you're drawn out to seek something, and then you contemplate, what is it? Unconditioned, unborn. Not a matter of time. Here and now, right? And you start to contemplate that. And that contemplation, that's not just thinking, makes you more and more let go. And then just trusting. And then trust is contrary to desire. You know, desire isn't trust. It's always trying to get to some deeper level or whatever it is. So we get great masters reporting back from the other side, as it were. You know, there are these possibilities, but it's very tempting to then follow that with desire. And yet, the third noble truth is the abandonment of desire. So it seems to me if you keep that teaching and focus, you keep watching desire, see how a suggestion of attainment might stimulate desire, or might stimulate a deeper investigation, which is wholesome. That's what you want to look at. So suggestions which then make you feel like I need to get something in the future, they're going to feed tanha. But suggestions which just stay here, be still, and get you diligent in that way seem to me more toward the unconditioned. But when you read Milne Paul Williams, and No Worries, have you read that? Oh, really? He does something that is just stunning. And you're in it. What has this man realized? And so if you have a read of it. And No Worries. It's in his autobiography. He's obviously realized something very, 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 very profound. And he says, I don't know what dukkha is. I've read the books about it, but I don't know what suffering is. And my mind was very silent, very still for the whole day, and then the next day, and then the next day. And it's been like that ever since. And that was 1969. Mm-hmm. And you read that, and my little fur goes up, and they go, wow. And you know, you see, okay, here's a man that's got something. And you don't have to define it, but okay, so certainly, so that's what I say, the masters report back to us. But his efforts he makes are incredible. But always keep saying, why do I practice? I practice for the sake of practice. I'm not talking about attainment, I just practice for the sake of practice. And for him, you know, practice seems to me that this is the way it is now. And obviously his mind's very, very focused and all that. But just before, the day before this kind of transformation, he falls into deep, deep dullness. Deep, he's sleeping, he just can't stay awake. I mean, just a practice for the sake of practice. So, we get the Buddha telling us about enlightenment and other teachers, but then what's the pathway? That's what we have to figure out. And we have to give up the goal. Because if we start thinking about the goal, it's very hard not to get the ego in there. And yet, you know, we read about that, we say, wow, I want that. I want more of that if I can. So it's very tempting. But if you contemplate, like Third Noble Truth, cessation of desire, then the sharpness of your mind is looking at tanha. And you get really good at noticing bhava vibhava, trying to become, trying to get rid of. You get really, you know your own character that way. So the sharpness is around panya and understanding and seeing the subtleties of those things. And then the objects of meditation can help you in that.
Do you do much body contemplation?
I do body awareness, but not, I don't contemplate like a, I don't do any intellectual contemplation, any visual. I don't visualize. I can't visualize a pencil. And I don't conceptualize. But I do use body energy a lot. Knowing body energy and in the sense of when the sense of self-identity, the body kind of falls away, then the body feels completely different and so on and so forth. So, but I've tried to stay away from conceptualization and more, and I don't visualize. I've never done like skeletal meditations or those kinds of super things and not found them. Because my nature is more towards aversion and fear, and so compassion and those kinds of things were much more attractive to me. You got it, yeah, you've got to pick it according to your own conditioning. See where the mind likes to go habitually and say, okay, so how could I awaken to that, notice it more quickly? Then you begin to trust yourself. Like, yeah, who's going to know my practice better than me? I'm living here. And then if another teacher says, "Oh, what you're doing is, you know, not really right on," you can say, "Well, that's your opinion." And you're going to need confidence in what works for you.
Yes, teachers tend to teach what works for them.
Exactly. Yeah, and they're all confident. Yeah, this is why you do it. So you get it. And that's, you know, because that's the way the mind works. So that's why you need to kind of just listen and say, yeah, well, maybe. But I'll give it a go first. And then if something works. What I found is there's certain types of teachings I could find them in non-Buddhist sources too that always nailed it for me. Somehow, what they were saying nailed it for my aspiration and for my insight. And I always pursue those writers and teachers. Others, in Buddhism, famous, I read them, I say, and not that they're wrong, not that they're not realized, but somehow, not my cup of tea. And that's the beauty of it, that there is just one way, in many ways. Well, so you're okay, Beatrice? Yeah, you'll be all right.
Yeah.
Your room's okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So shall we call it a? So we have a meditation at 7 o'clock here, and
5 o'clock.
And 5 in the morning.
Okay.
Yeah.
So oh, today.
Yeah, today.
Okay.
So 7, and I've got to get you an alarm clock. So 7 o'clock we come in, and usually you get a cushion and so on. So come in maybe like a few minutes early, and the monks come in. The abbot's been missing a few meditations, I've heard. But then we have these green chanting books. Take one of those, and Venerable Chunda leads the chanting. He'll tell you what page. And then we do some ritual bowing. Don't worry about it. You can be an anthropologist and watch. Yeah? And then we meditate for about an hour. And if you find that too long, if you want to slip out quietly, no problem. But if you want to switch to a chair, you can do that. But if you find the meditation works, stay with it. And then after the hour, then we have another brief chant, and then we finish with some ritual bowing, and then that's it. And the same in the morning. Okay? Mm-hmm. All right. But like I say, you can be an anthropologist and just take notes of what we do. Have you got a background in Buddhism at all, or just a bit of reading?
I've been doing retreats. I'm in 10 days course with Asan Goenka.
Okay.
And I've been reading a little bit.
Okay.
And listening to these courses on the internet.
Okay. Okay. And same with Adrian too. You know, a lot of people come from Goenka's retreats. It's interesting. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. See you at 7 or 5 or 7 or sometime.